teased Thema during my time to respond to the work, that she actually didn't give it all away. And that's a wonderful thing, because she was protecting the medicine by not saying, even giving the name of the medicine, how it was harvested, where it was harvested, the time of year, you know, all of the details that industry especially needs to capitalize upon indigenous knowledge through their extraction practices. So there was this beautiful holding, protecting of indigenous knowledge, as much as the physical was given away in that space and ingested, even with the teas, the big copper bowl that Thema made with that really rich, I think it was primarily rose hip was the base of the tea. And it was the first time ever that my little guy had even tried tea before. So that was really sweet to see him so excited. to share in its medicinal value, but to not give that information away of even what all went into that tea.
Haley, would you like to share a little bit, because you helped with the sewing of the copper pennies and assisted Thema in that process? Is there anything that you wanted to share for that question on ceremony as a shared experience?
I just like to acknowledge how grateful I am to have been able to help with the setup of the exhibition. And I was aware of what Thema was planning on doing with the blanket at the end of the ceremony. And she like made me aware before I started the sewing, and we were really excited about it.
So in the recording of the conversation that happened, and unfortunately I couldn't attend, I was really struck by Mike Yell's description of the power of dismantling something and giving it away. And specifically this sort of history of Chilkat blankets cut and then given in potlatch, and then those later being made into garments or regalia. I really appreciated sort of her description of how this is a way of being, and also her later description of protocol as a form of structure that guides us in our efforts, and specifically that protocol is really about teachings that guide us in our efforts. So I was really grateful for that discussion. And also Alicia's discussion of this question around what do we share with a public? What do we sort of hold, you know, within different spaces? I think about sort of different groups that we're in relation to. So sometimes it's our family, our clan, our larger community of our folks that, you know, our Indigenous nations. And I've often sort of erred on the side of a kind of generative refusal to share embodied ways of being, but not to share the actual teachings themselves in an exhibition. I think she's really asking an important question about this sort of like line about how we ethically navigate these questions. And I think that Thema really addressed that throughout her preparation for this project, through all of these sort of thinking and being on the land and the sewing and the making. She had this rigorous practice. I was able to mentor Thema, although I must clarify that this really was a reciprocal relationship where I learned just as much as I shared. I think that partly my role was to encourage, to listen, to provide feedback from my perspective as someone who has never potlatched. Those old practices of feasting and dancing and singing, while they're being renewed on my island, I've never participated in a potlatch before, and I don't know that that's the word that we would use to describe what we have done historically and are in the process of reinvigorating. But I know that Thema really took all of these questions very seriously about how she's citing these deeply powerful processes through this, in this rigorous practice. And as Haley said, Thema is reinvigorating, you know, Tultan philosophies and practices in different strategies, in different ways within the community and in her artistic practice. So just think that this attention that Alicia brought to this question is quite powerful. Partly it has to do with the fact that Potlatch is very public. And so in some regards, as Mike Yell has explained, it is different from some of the other ceremonial practices that other Indigenous people participate in. But I just deeply appreciated all of the comments throughout.
We are really excited about it and the whole process and idea of something that is like being degraded from its original form, but not really, because it's being passed to all the witnesses in the ceremony, and everybody gets to take a piece of this exhibition, this experience, home with them. The spirituality and the power in that, people from all different tribes, people from all different parts of the world were there, and it was just really beautiful to play a part in that. And I was really happy that she wanted me to help with the exhibition. Yeah, I don't know. I wish I was there to experience it firsthand. I did, however, still get a goodie bag, and I do have my piece with me as well. I'm really, really grateful. Yeah, I love that idea of the cyclical relationship of something that is being made for this ceremony, for this business, but just because it is, we have this society, this way of looking at, we don't destroy things that are made to be seen. We have this like sense of ownership over the idea of art and the idea of making and creating art. That's something like cutting up a tapestry is viewed as like painful, and it's almost like a breakthrough in a way. But that really ties into the idea of spirituality and my connection to my culture, is that everything continues to take new forms. Everything's constantly transforming. Everything is connected. Whether or not, like, we are saying goodbye to the tapestry in its full form, we are still entering new beginnings for everyone who was involved. And I find that really beautiful.
Thank you. Mikael, would you like to choose our next question for you, Alicia, and maybe also Haley to respond to?
I was really drawn to question number one, because really, for me, having grown up in our potlatch system here in Metlakatla, Alaska, one completes the other. It would be incomplete, and you really couldn't fully potlatch. You can't fully potlatch without having witnesses, without paying those witnesses. And then the doing of business is why you're there, why you've worked so hard to get there. So it's the doing of business happens long before the potlatch. That's everything that has happened to get to the potlatch and everything that happens at the potlatch. So these concepts are, they're interrelated, and it's not to say that they always have to happen in a particular order, because there's so much witnessing that happens pre-potlatch that it's not talked about as much, but the passing down of knowledge that relates to the reason for the potlatch happens throughout the family especially, and is so, so strong, so that they can stand together, the family or clan. We primarily potlatch as families here, and there's a lot of multi-clan potlatches. Our system is of potlatching is very different here. In terms of, we have four clans, so it's not always about our opposites. And we have many potlatches that are multiple days long, that one clan will take a day. So the relationship, that symbiotic is a perfect word, I think, to talk about it, because of the way that one doesn't exist without the other. And all of those terms, witnessing, giving, doing business, you know, protocol is another one that I would put up there because of my work on specifically on dancing sovereignty, that, you know, each of these parts of the potlatch has their own protocol. And really, it's about structure and about, you know, sometimes people think laws are too, the word law is too heavy, but it's essentially what guides us in our efforts. And these are teachings. Teachings guide us in our efforts and to stay true to who we are as nations, family, and communities. So I thought it was a really important question to consider, and also to consider it in relation to Thema's work and to consider it into the gallery space. Because, you know, I would say that I've seen artists along the Northwest Coast do a lot of business in gallery spaces, but more of the business of like standing up people, acknowledging from their efforts, talking about their own clan or community identity. But it wasn't a potlatch. There wasn't gifts. There wasn't here are the witnesses for what the business that has happened here, and even the word using the word business and doing business. So I think that's where Thema's practice really, again, to use that word, decolonize, but indigenize that space to say that this is a place of potlatch. Without saying this is a place of potlatch. It was the practice of potlatch through all of those witnessing, giving, and doing business that made Thema, that performance really exist in so many different realms simultaneously.
Thank you. Alicia, would you like to respond to that question number one? Can read it if you want. What sort of connections do you derive from the act of witnessing, giving, and doing business? And is there a symbiotic relationship between these concepts? What do they mean for you?
I think when it comes to, if this is more of like a event or ceremony or gathering type of setting, I've been to a lot of events where it is like witnessing, and I'm not really familiar with like the potlatch like protocols or even like the bigger, more official like ceremonies, but I think it's just a form of reciprocity, and it's the giving and the taking. And I enjoyed the part of Thema's gallery where you would take a cup, drink from the tea, and then also place the cup on this type of shelf it's, you place the cup there when you're done with it, but then you were also able to grab a program kind of in a sense of an exchange, which was very interesting to me. And her program was like her poster that had the information on her exhibition. And yeah, it was quite the interesting concept that really had me thinking. Yeah.
Thank you, Alicia. Is there anything you would like to add, Haley, for that question on the act of witnessing, giving, and doing business, and symbiotic relationships between the concepts?
I think I really appreciate the polarity between what it is to do business in an Indigenous setting with an Indigenous philosophies as compared to what we view as business and lawmaking in current colonized capitalistic society. I like, Mikhail, that you mentioned earlier that law we view as such a heavy word, which already like points to the connotations that we have it as being something clinical and impersonal and serious, when in Indigenous culture, it's a form of connection. There's so much love and welcoming and respect in everything that we do with our business, and that everybody is involved. It is it's a mutually beneficial agreement, and it's something that we just kind of know in our hearts is how it needs to be done. It needs to be done with genuine intentions and with integrity. And that way you know what you're doing is right. And you have the people there to witness it, and everyone agrees. I feel like a lot of times now in politics and in government, a lot is happens behind the scenes. A lot is kept from the general public and from like society in general. And we don't have that connection and that respect that was shown by, from our ancestors in our pre-colonized ways of dealing with things and being and knowing. And so it's a big topic for me. It's something I really, really want to study more and to revitalize and bring into my own interactions in daily life of being respectful of the people I work with, the dynamics I have in my family, in my relationships, and recognizing that we all have a role to play and we need to be aware of that and conscious of that in everything that we do, not just in ceremony, but in life, because things we do in ceremony are a reflection of the people that we want to be and the relationships that we want to have in our daily lives.
A couple of those comments were how Maikiel acknowledged that the practice or the what occurred in the performance, Thema's performance, was existing in so many realms simultaneously. I think this is a really important and adept observation. I think that Thema's intention was perhaps not to enact ceremony, but to cite those practices. And yet sometimes in that citation or in that action, we are sort of bringing that intention and that energy to the work that we're doing. I felt that she was really living by this sort of, you know, ethic of reciprocity that Alicia spoke to, and also that Haley spoke to, that ceremony is a reflection of what we want to be in daily life. And so if you think about it that way, Thema was really taking these principles or the ethos or the action of potlatch and deploying that or enacting those principles in this performance. And then the impact of that is quite profound, as we heard from everyone who attended the performance or who were a part of the exhibition.
Thank you, Haley, for writing our descriptions and guiding our conversation and creating those really rich and resonant questions that had so many different aspects to think through together. Thank you all.
So before we log off today, part ways, and return to the chaos of our daily lives, I want to take this moment to express gratitude for this meeting. I want to acknowledge the roles that we all play in not only witnessing, but breathing life into an experience and fulfilling the relationship between speaker and listener and host and visitor. I want to say Madhu, which is thank you in the Tel-Ten language. Madhu to our witnesses and talented speakers, Tanya, who's not with us today, Alicia and Maikiel, thank you for sharing your thoughts and adding endless substance to this gathering. Madhu to Christy and Christopher for the time and energy you've extended towards the exhibition as well as this meeting. Your efforts do not go unnoticed. And finally, I want to say Madhu to Thema for her ongoing work in revitalizing Indigenous philosophies and specifically Tel-Ten ways of knowing and being. I also want to extend gratitude on her behalf to everyone who joined us here today to discuss her work and her art and the legacy that she is creating. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening. That ends part one of our presentation of witnessing Thema Igaris, there is actually a pronunciation guide, but it's still a wee challenge. Hukadeskwelch. So witnessing Thema Igaris Hukadeskwelch. That was a part of a presentation of Thema Igaris's performance of Hukadeskwelch at the SFU Gallery in the fall of 2022. And then what we've been listening to is a discussion of that performance and the issues it raised. And we will be presenting part two. The speakers you were hearing in that discussion were Tanya Luke and Linklater, Alicia Johnny Hawkins, and Mikkel D'Angeli. That we will be back next week at the same time at Tuesday at 10 a.m. on December 19th for part two of this very interesting discussion. And I hope you will be back here with us next week. Now we have, coming up in a couple of moments, we have a personal reflection of the experience as a newcomer and an international student of arriving here in Canada alone, right at the beginning of the pandemic. I think we all found the pandemic, well, it's still with us, and it still affects us. And it was in many ways, a sort of shocking sort of thing to go through, even though at the same time, you know, the it seemed to be something experienced in the sense of an absence, because all of a sudden we were all stuck at home. Perusi Wanchea was an international student coming to Canada to study at SFU, and she arrived right at the beginning of the pandemic, and had the misfortune of not only arriving right at the beginning of the pandemic before we really understood everything that was going on, but on a flight with other people who had been infected, and the consequent infection that she received herself. This is her personal reflection on that. And recorded here for CJSF, and I hope you enjoy this.
Hi everyone, my name is Perusi Wanyancha, and I'm a student in the Semester in Dialogue class 392, and today I'll be talking about my experience with the pandemic as an international student who just landed in Canada. And I'm recording live from CJSF FM radio studio. The year is 2021, and COVID is still making headlines. Everyone at the airport had their masks on, which seemed pointless as people took them off in the plane. After a 26-hour trip, the paranoia of contracting the disease got me. What would it be like to get COVID in a new country? An international student in a swamped Canadian healthcare system with no public health insurance, now actually suffering from a pandemic. Flashback to the day I landed in Vancouver, waiting for my older sister to pick me up from the airport. Our joy overflowed despite COVID restrictions, limiting us to a distant hug. I was ready to break the self-quarantine rule to explore this new place. Little did I know it would be a long, insufferable night of solitude in an empty basement apartment. I woke up in the middle of the night with a headache and could not go back to sleep due to jet lag. My head was banging like a hammer hitting on a wall, which only got worse by the second. I could feel my pulse rate on both sides of my head, extending to my eyes. Soon after, all other symptoms crept in all at once. At this point, I'm thinking, this is it. There is no way I'm going to survive this. A fever accompanied with intense chills followed, making my pajamas soaking wet after sweating profusely. It is as if someone poured ice on me while lying in bed. The feeling of hopelessness had me sobbing with a runny nose. All these symptoms were pointing to COVID, honestly. It felt like the end of the world. There was nobody to call at 2 a.m. Mind you, I'm supposed to be self-isolating, and my sister lived at least an hour away from my apartment by public transport. It was 7 a.m. in the morning, and my symptoms were getting worse. My sister called to check on me, and I mustered up the courage to talk to her. I downplayed the severity of my sickness, sought to hide the truth from my parents. I felt like a prisoner in an empty basement apartment. Except a prisoner had a better shot at surviving with better medical insurance, honestly. As an international student, I had private medical insurance at the moment that only covered for injuries and would have to pay out of pocket, then get reimbursed after assessment. Provincial medical insurance was not a choice, since it takes 3 months to be in effect. My last resort was the holistic approach that relied only on Mother Nature instead of medical care. My sister sent DoorDash to my doorstep with a recovery package. Lemon juice, ginger, garlic, citrus juice, and food to boost my immune system. I made a concoction with the raw ingredients in hot water and drank it for a whole week. Most of the food bought was already pre-cooked to ease my food preparations. Every sip and every bite felt like a warm embrace from my beloved sister. Oh, what a relief to know you're cared for by loved ones, even from a distance. Upon reflection with the Canadian healthcare system, I started comparing the treatment options with that of my home country, Tanzania. The major setback is how slow the system is to respond to the patient. Insurance takes a long time to process and issue as they wait for the 6-month time frame that proves the eligibility for temporary residency. In Tanzania, once you pay for that insurance, everything gets covered, including drugs. So the pressure is not really on whether you can afford the treatment, but rather on the accuracy of that diagnosis. This is where Canadian healthcare outshines Tanzania. The long wait times can be discouraging, but rest assured the treatment will be more precise. Eventually, I told my parents. However, they were powerless to intervene with the system. Throughout this experience, I've developed greater mental resilience, allowing me to reflect with confidence on my ability to overcome challenges, including my upcoming surgery. I dedicate this written piece to every immigrant out there, especially international students who have no one to rely on when life throws lemons. The lesson is to be more self-sufficient so that nothing shakes you. The pandemic has sparked a conversation about healthcare sector shortcomings and the need to enhance responsiveness. As the general public, advocating for those with an unearned disadvantage involves addressing disparities in Medicare access for immigrants, who, despite not paying taxes like Canadian citizens and permanent residents, contribute significantly to the country's economy. The pandemic has sparked a conversation about healthcare sector shortcomings and the need to enhance responsiveness. As the general public, advocating for those with an unearned disadvantage involves addressing disparities in Medicare access for immigrants, who, despite not paying taxes like Canadian citizens and permanent residents, contribute significantly to the country's economy. International students alone contribute over $22.3 billion per year. Imagine how much more can be made with medical coverage adjustment. Food for thought, huh?
Thank you to Parusi Wanchaya, and that was her reflection on her experience of arriving here in Canada as an international student into the thick of the COVID pandemic. Here is, well, we're just about out of time here at the CJSF and at Speak Up. We're going to finish the show off with a bit of Ani DeFranco, and she's just recently released a 25th anniversary version re-release of her album Little Plastic Castles. This is the lead-off track from that, Little Plastic Castles. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up in about a minute.
In a coffee shop in a city, which is every coffee shop in every city, on a day which is every day, I picked up a magazine, which is every magazine. I read a story, then I forgot it. right away. And they say goldfish have no memory. I guess their lives are much like mine. And the little plastic castle is a surprise every time. And it's hard to say